This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 62. Me who's enlightenment or not. And the pointer. Bodhidharma's highest truth, Emperor Wu's confusion, Vimalakirti's teaching of non-duality, Manjushri's verbal excess. Is there anyone who has the ability to enter in actively? The main case. Mihu had a student ask Master Yangshan, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? The student went back and reported this to Mihu. He deeply agreed with this. The verse. The secondary, distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion, quickly you should free your hands and relinquish net and trap. Accomplishment, before it's exhausted, becomes an extra thumb. Wisdom can hardly know, like you can't bite your own navel. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breeze is chill. Brought forth, great Yang distinguishes real and false. Completely without flaw, the white jade is esteemed. We should remember that Master Hong Zhe, who put this collection together, was an exceptional poet. I'm very grateful to him for that. So good morning. So why would Mihu, his name was Jing Zhao Mihu, and Yangshan were Dharma brothers. So they studied together with Guishan, the same, they had the same teacher. And this is 9th century China. And so Mihu sends a messenger, a student, to his Dharma brother to ask this question, do people these days need enlightenment or not? Why would he ask such a question? So here he's a monastic, a monk, a teacher, he's got his own sangha, he's teaching his Dharma brother in a similar situation. They've devoted their lives to the Buddha Dharma, to awakening. Why would he ask this question? These teachers were not interested in wasting time. In fact, they were interested in using time most carefully. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing here and now. The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? Dogen says. I and all beings attain the way at the same time, the Buddha said at his enlightenment. Enlightenment in Buddhism has a very particular meaning. It's a word that has been translated into English as enlightenment. It has meaning in different religions, in Western civilization, philosophically, as a period of time that influenced different art forms. What is enlightenment in Buddhism? To see the real nature of things, to see the non-duality of all things, the 10,000 things return to one, in two, nothing is divided. The unity of the two truths, the relative experience we have of the world and the fundamental, beyond all knowing. What do we know when we think about our world? We can be greedy, we have anger within us, hatred, fear, and jealousy. We envy, we can be confused, indifferent, lazy. These are all the expressions of what we call our deluded mind that arise out of the sense of a separate self. They inhabit and create views within us, ways we perceive things. They sort of infiltrate our consciousness through our senses, and they create a world. So who among us would deny that there's pain and suffering in the world? That's pretty obvious. Who would argue that it's difficult to attain inner and outer peace? What else do we know? Everyone wants to be happy, at peace, serene, free of fear. That the world within us cannot be separated from the world without. We have to look a little more closely to see that, but it's pretty clear if we look a little closer. And that those two worlds become each other. They arise together. What are the implications of that? That the mind of one cannot be separated from the mind of others. We have to look a bit more carefully to see that, that there is only one mind, and that our karmic conditioning creates a sense of separateness, of self, a kind of continual self-referencing experience. That my experience of the world seems very much to me to be the world. So within the deluded view, we're not aware of how our consciousness or our senses and our karmic history, past and present, is actively creating and actively recreating and changing, morphing reality into something that, in essence, affirms our identity, which can be right side up and it can be upside down. I was reading, there was just an op-ed in the Times the other day by a person named Farhad Manju. And he's been a technology journalist for over 20 years and a devotee of technology for much longer. And that he says, over time, I've been obsessed with how digital experience scrambles how we make sense of the real world. Technology may have liberated us from the old gatekeepers, but it also created a culture of choose-your-own-fact niches, of all elevated conspiracy thinking to the center of public consciousness, and brought the incessant nightmare of high school click drama to every human endeavor. Like, that's where we're at. Right? Having survived high school once, now it's like... And so he goes on to say, so to survive the brain-dissolving internet and technology, he turned to meditation. And then he goes on to talk about the benefits of meditation. He says, I hope you give it a try. I hope everyone does. He says, I'm not promising meditation will fix everything about how the internet has ruined you, but what if it does? And you know, this really plays into the idea that first of all, what is meditation, you know? And so what do millions and millions of people think when they hear that word, much less do? And then that mentality of this will fix this. Having created this, let's fix it with this. That's the kind of thinking, right, that created the thing that we're trying to fix. And so in Mihu's question, do people these days need enlightenment or not? This is a very deep, deep question. Looking at it at the surface, it can just seem, well, of course we need enlightenment. Of course we need wisdom, right? Because we don't want to live in the nightmare of a high school click drama in every human endeavor. Because the world is in trouble. We are in trouble because we are creating trouble in the world, for the world. We need enlightenment in every form, in every shade, to every degree. Seems self-evident. Why would he ask this question? In enlightened conversation, a question gives life and it takes it away. It holds on and it lets go. It raises waves, as old masters would say. The ocean fundamentally is calm and peaceful. This question raises waves, stirs things. Because that's kind of how we work, right? When things are stirring, we feel the wave, right? It's like we feel a kind of disturbance. It gets our attention. And then what happens next, you know, is in a sense the history of the world. But for practitioners, what happens is we pay attention, right? We understand that inside and outside are not two. That self and other fundamentally are one reality. That what I do and what happens is one thing. The past and present can't be separated. Do these people these days need enlightenment or not? The footnote says, have they ever been deluded? And this is, in a sense, the fundamental problem. We think the fundamental problem is delusion itself. Dukkha. Not really. The fundamental problem is thinking that we're deluded. And not even knowing, in fact, that we think we're deluded. That's the fundamental problem. That's why the Buddha, one of the reasons I think why the Buddha originally considered not teaching. How is he going to devote his life to presenting a teaching that, in effect, by its very presentation, would be creating a false idea? By starting with life is dukkha, we all get that. There are problems, inner and outer. But that within that very experience, and the sort of inarguable truth of that, that fundamentally, it isn't what we think it is. And so because of this, have we ever been deluded? There's all of this. Teachings, practice, intimate communication, skillful means, building monasteries, raising bodhicitta, training, taking the precepts, ordaining, all of this. Because, not because life is suffering, but because we have never been deluded. A national teacher, Zhang, once asked his attendant, what does Buddha mean? And the student said, it means enlightened. And the national teacher said, has a Buddha ever been deluded? And the student said, no, never. And then the national teacher said, then what's the use of enlightenment? This has everything to do with everything. I like how that takes it all in. This has everything to do with everything. So let's narrow that down just a little bit. It has everything to do with everything for a practitioner. Everything. What practice is, what the teachings are, what they're pointing to, how we practice, what we do with our minds, our bodies, our thoughts, what desires arise within us and how we respond to them, how we create a sangha and live together, how liturgy takes form, everything. Do people these days need enlightenment or not? That question is informing everything that we do. And of course, it's easy to understand from an ordinary view, right? It seems, you know, for any reasonably concerned person, it seems self-evident. Dogen says in Fukan Sazengi, the true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? Has there ever been delusion? He says, indeed, the whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? Not being deluded is our fundamental nature. How would you brush that clean? And so when a student asked Yangshan this question, Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment. But what can be done about falling into the secondary? You know, I think the question to people these days need enlightenment or not, also in our time has, and maybe not just in our time, but because of communication and internet and sort of being everywhere at once, the sense that, and just the way Buddhism develops, you know, it's hard to actually do this. Have you noticed that? It's hard to actually do this. It's not hard to do it for a moment, right? Or for a couple of moments, or for a day, or for a month, or whatever time period it isn't hard for, but then it becomes hard. And what is that hard? What is hard? And so because that is true, and has always been true, the Buddha said it's a long path. When we encounter hard, we look for easy, right? Hard is hard. So where's the easy outlet, right? And so Buddhism, historically and in the present, will always have sort of that spectrum of what we might call hard or what we might call just, you know, practice and enlightenment. Actually awakening Buddha mind in this body and mind, in your body and mind, in this life that we have, in a true way, in a real way. And then there are all of the gradations, all of the whole spectrum of, and that doesn't mean, you know, you have to give up your life and become a monastic. It just means, in essence, it means having that faith that you have never been deluded. Your life looks like this. Okay. What about those two seemingly disparate worlds? What are we to do? That's where practice arises. And so it's recognizing that and giving a shit and trying to do something about it. Because you need it. I need it. We need it of each other. Our world needs it. What better offering could we make? But it's always, there are always going to be moments where we encounter difficult, hard, obstacle, obstruction, impediment, hindrance, all of these words that point to this. Have they ever been deluded? But delusion's a rough ride. And so we look for easy. And our culture is sort of a factory for giving us what appears to be easy. But the other side of easy is somebody's paying the cost of the hard part of that. To make this easy, right? Because there are no free lunches. Somebody else is carrying the cost of that, of the hard. So if it's cheap, somebody else is actually carrying the cost of the cost. And so if we think of training, the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva, the 10 ox herding pictures, the path to liberate self and other, to liberate the world, right? Because it's not going to be any good if we're liberated, I'm enlightened, I'm at peace, I'm serene, but the world is a total, you know, shithole. It's a mess. So what good is my liberation, my equanimity, my serenity when the world is not serene? So self and other has to be liberated. World and things have to be liberated. Past, present, and future have to be liberated. You know, the path of avoiding, so when we encounter something that's difficult and we start looking for the easy, that's that one, that excellent path of avoidance, right? Going straight is hard. Let's just hang a left, right? So the path of avoiding is the path of frustration and disappointment, guaranteed, right? Buddhism doesn't make many promises, but it gives you a few. The promise is, when we avoid things, we will become frustrated, we will be disappointed. It's just going to happen. It's happening. It's like trying to want to run away from our own heartbeat, right? The faster we run, the louder and the faster it becomes. The path of attachment is like catching wind in a bottle. You never quite get it. It keeps eluding. And so we can think, encountering Buddhism, that if we just encounter emptiness, if we just have a realization of emptiness, and all of those bonds that are binding us will be realized as empty, gone, broken, shattered, collapsed, freedom. Yet Hakuin says, and 1,000, 10,000, 100 other teachings and teachers have said, yet, having realized emptiness, when you come back into contact with differentiations, defiling conditions of turmoil and confusion, agitation and vexation, love and hate, that is the secondary, you will find yourself helpless, and all the miseries of existence will press in upon you again. And so, when Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? What can be done when we come into contact with all of the thingness of the world? Which it means this world, too. So in the beginning of practice, we practice letting go of what we believe is true and of what we oftentimes don't really want to let go of, that appear as thoughts and emotions, memories, plans, aspects of identity. And because they do seem to reflect the world, what's true, what we've always relied upon, and the Buddha calls from the wings something separate, something distinct, something permanent. That's how they appear. Because they do appear that way, which promises that they're going to give us what we want, the deluded mind, subject and object, because of that, we don't deny, avoid, suppress, overrule. Because it isn't the world, but it appears as the world. It isn't who you are, but it appears as who you are. It isn't true, but it's not entirely false. Because of that, we don't deny it. We don't avoid. And so then, but because they do, those appearances do deceive us, we get caught in them. Their energy pulls us in and we get stuck. They confuse us. They obscure the real nature of things. We don't attach to them. We don't cling to them. And in that, body and mind begin to settle. Letting go becomes more and more natural. We already know. You know, if we hadn't already known and been letting go in many moments, we would have died a long time ago, just suffocated under the weight of it. But it becomes more and more natural. And grasping, on the other hand, actually becomes uncomfortable. It becomes painful. As we begin to see within, underneath, beyond the immediate gratification of desires that arise, things that we would normally run after, wrap ourselves up in or around. Fear, insecurity, tension, distrust, anxiety. We begin to see all of those things within the grasping. we realize grasping is not just like a mechanical act. Right? Grasping is not in my hand. It certainly isn't in the stick. And while I can do this and everything seems fine, when it's grasping, it's not fine. Why do I grasp? What is that serving? Why is it necessary to grasp? And so there's fear and anxiety within it, always. And in that we begin to see how accustomed we have become to our own discomfort. Kind of. Accustomed, it's being accustomed because we're not really experiencing discomfort. Because we have, in the power of our consciousness, found different ways to keep it at a distance. That's what avoidance and grasping does. So when we avoid stuff, we can understand how that sort of distances us from something, which is the point. But when we're grasping at something, we would think, well, now that's up close, so I see it. But that's not actually the way it is. It's like when we're really lost in our anger, there's a sense somewhere within us that there is anger and that somehow we're involved in it. But it is very, very different than being mindful within anger. One, there is awareness, and the other, there isn't. And the karma of that is very different. And so we begin to see how accustomed we've been to our dis-ease. And in that dis-ease becomes stronger. It gets harder, right? Because the buffers are falling away. And so then we have to really become accustomed or comfortable with actually being uncomfortable. You know, when I talk about this, I can't overstate. The importance of this is big. Right? Because if we are not, I mean, that's what attachment is all about, is avoiding the discomfort. It's like an addiction. And so in order for that to shift fundamentally, we have to encounter our discomfort in a real way, not a word that I bring up in a talk. And I remember when my teacher would talk about that, and I would say, yes, that's what I want, because that's the way through. Bring it on. And then when it appears, it's like, oh, this just sucks. Right? I don't want this. I want it, but not like this. So that's what we've been conditioned to do, is avoid that discomfort. And so we have to actually become adept, proficient, skillful, courageous about experiencing discomfort, but it's not just enduring it. That's the power. That's why it is empowering and not debilitating. It is because we're meeting it within, on that seat of our own power. We begin to see that thoughts about things are just often just simply not true. Just not true, period. They are never the thing itself. They're often not helpful. They're often not necessary. I don't need to be thinking about this. So why am I thinking about it? Am I going to live forever? It doesn't matter. That they don't have their own power, that they are not the self. Moments of attention and alertness and mindfulness become more present, more familiar, more sustained, more stable. The body begins to relax. We really begin to understand and experience the unity of body and mind. Right? In the early days, I just thought, because I was used to, you know, sports and being very physical and just enduring a lot of pain, and I just thought, it doesn't really matter what's happening here. It doesn't matter. If it's pain, that's okay. I can endure that. All I need to do is enlighten my mind, and that's it. And that isn't it. That didn't work. And so eventually I realized I can't separate these. I've been practicing as though I could, and I can't because it's not working. I'm destroying this, right? My mind is not actually finding stability, serenity, depth. And then we continue until the mind, subject, object, past and present, inner and outer, cannot be found. Practice itself cannot be found. And at that moment, what is it? A student once asked, "Do the eminent sages since antiquity arrive at the real truth?" And Mihu said, "Yes." And the student said, "If it's the real truth, how can it be arrived at?" And that's really the story of Buddhism, the story of Buddhist practice. How can it be arrived at? And yet arrived at it must. Do people these days need enlightenment or not? Absolutely. The world depends upon it. Do people these days need enlightenment or not? Don't slander the Buddhas and ancestors. It's not that there's no enlightenment, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? That's why Hakuin says to realize emptiness and then to turn and face the world. And that's what the Denok Sering pictures are describing. That's what training is. And it starts really at the beginning. So when a student, when you first come in, you receive instruction, your responsibility is to do Zazen. That's it. When you're in the Zendo, that's it. That's how you fulfill your responsibility to the Sangha. And then if you continue at a certain point, you're going to be given different responsibilities to make this work. Because while you're just sitting there fulfilling your responsibility, other people are carrying responsibilities to help you be able to do that. Which means they're beginning to, within their own practice, which is letting go of all things, letting go of all phenomena, giving up all concerns, they are given a concern. Hold this concern. Now, don't put those in opposition. So it really starts at the very early stages of training, because we need a long time to work on this. What can be done about the secondary? The footnote says, how can you avoid it? How can you avoid the secondary? That's oftentimes what we think. If I'm just become enlightened, then the world will somehow still be there, but also just go away. It'll be there, but it won't bother me anymore. It won't be a bother. It won't be a concern, but I'll be compassionate. Right? Work that out. But in a sense, it's true. How do you have deep concern, but without inner turmoil, without attachments, without avoidance? Having realized things are not as they seem, what do we do about things? Seeing clearly that, as Vimalakirti said, that dukkha is the result of a total involvement in unreal mental constructions since the beginning of time. What do we do about those constructions, thoughts and emotions? An enlightened being continues to have thoughts. When they touch something, they feel hot or cold. Emotions arise. How do they experience that, what we call the secondary? The footnote says, how can you avoid it? And that doesn't just mean it will continue to arise. It's not something apart. When the wind blows from the west, the leaves scatter to the east. When the alarm sounds, we open our eyes, feet touch the floor. You stand and get dressed. Where is the one? Where is the secondary? Where is the sacred? Where is the mundane? Where is the gap? To speak of enlightened or not enlightened is an unreal mental construction. And that's why he says in the poem, the secondary distinguishing enlightenment, breaking up delusion, quickly free your hand, relinquish the net and trap. There's the famous sutra in which the Buddha talks about, you know, when you come to a wide river that you need to cross, you build a raft. You build the raft to carry you across. That's skillful. When you get across the river, there's no point in putting the raft on your back and carrying it. It served its purpose. And so quickly free your hands and relinquish the net and trap. An old teaching says a trap is how to get a rabbit. When the rabbit is caught, you drop the trap. A net is how to get fish. When the fish is caught, you forget the net. Words are a trap for images. Images are nets for ideas. Those who keep the words are not those who get the image. Those who keep the image are not those who get the idea. And so beginning with, you have never been deluded. And yet, as Dogen says, if there's even if there's a hair's breadth deviation, it's like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So put aside intellectual practice of investigating words and phrases and take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. And then along the way to realize that everything that we use to do that is the trap, is the net. It's essential, it's beautiful, it's exquisite. It has been developed and honed over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It comes to us well tested. And in that way, we have a responsibility to hold that net, that trap, that raft, to put it to good use, and then to sustain it so others can use it. Ultimately, how we use it is by realizing it's just a construction. And when we hear that, our dualistic mind thinks, well, that means it's not important. If it's just a construction, it's not something that has absolute truth or absolute validity, that means it's not important. And that's not true. That's our one side or the other mind. It's vitally important. It is life and death important. And it is vitally important because it's not a thing. That's what's so exquisite. So that when we attach to it, to practice, to the forms of practice we use, to the Dharma, to any aspect of anything, in a sense, we're desecrating it. We're not honoring the exquisite nature of that thing. And so he says, accomplishment before it's exhausted becomes an extra thumb. So if you put the raft on your back, that's a heavy load you got to carry now, an extra thumb. Wisdom can hardly know. It's like you can't bite your own navel. Wisdom is not about knowing itself. And then he goes on. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. What a beautiful image. The full moon's icy disk weeps in the autumn dew. Everywhere you look, you see the face of the Buddha. You encounter the great heart of compassion. Whose face is that? Whose heart is that? The birds are cold in the jade tree. The dawn breeze is chill. Coolness in this poetry often is invoking emptiness, the place of that is lacking in warmth. It's like the chill of winter where all the life of spring and summer has died. Right, the whole earth is covered in white. One flavor, one taste. No differentiation. And so the birds are cold in the jay tree and the dawn breeze is chill. From within that, he goes on to say, Yangshan brings forth and distinguishes right and wrong. That's why, in practice, we have to let go of all of the many forms of right and wrong, of avoiding and denying, so that we can live within a world of right and wrong. We have to let go of things so that we can navigate and move within things. We have to let go of thoughts and emotions so we can live within a body of thoughts and emotions and the bodies of others. In a sense, we have to let go entirely of enlightenment in order to awaken enlightenment so that we can distinguish what is true and what is not true. Completely without flaw, the white jade is esteemed. You're like this, I'm like this. The footnote says, just don't glom onto it. Just don't glom onto it. Let it be as it is. Let that which is sitting on your cushion be as it is. And then in that place, we move, we act. You know, this is where seeing things as they are, accepting the reality on the ground of reality, from a dualistic way of thinking, can be misunderstood as being complacent, being passive, not caring. So to give up all of our concerns is so that we can know how do we care, so that that caring is true caring and isn't actually creating more suffering. And the reason we have to let go entirely of that very thing that we want to bring to life is because what we're letting go of is not the thing, it's the idea of the thing. It's all of our karma around the thing. You know, getting caught is just a normal part of the path. So, you know, it's like I was saying to somebody recently, you know, getting lost along the way is easy. If you haven't gotten lost yet, you're probably not practicing. Because you can't get lost if you're not practicing. Everybody gets lost. Finding your way back, that's where the work is really there. From the beginning, without flaw, the white jade is esteemed, the pearl. To really appreciate, you know, that teaching can be so powerful. And just immediately, I've met so many students over the years who heard that, and because they saw themselves as so imperfect, so tarnished, so flawed, that was just like a life-giving phrase. Perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And that's just like wisdom touching wisdom. Truth meeting truth. But the practice of that is a subtle thing indeed. and requires our keen attention. And that's just not an idea. You know, when I was talking last week about my mother dying and, you know, working with clay because she'd been a ceramicist all her life, and I said, you know, that in those moments, almost beyond consciousness, she was able to bring forth her training. You know, and I said, this is our training. But in order for us to be able to take refuge in that, for it to have that present spontaneously or to deliberately and consciously turn towards it, we have to have actually done that training, right? So when all hell's breaking loose, and what you really need is to be very grounded and present, in other words, to be able to be mindful and present in that moment, if we haven't cultivated that, it's going to be very hard to do that. It's a good desire, but there's not much training to turn to, right? There's not much refuge to take refuge in. That's why ongoing practice is so important. That's all.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.